Frankenstein's monster has been a star of the silver screen for basically the entire history of cinema.
Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Hello, handsome! You're a good-looking fellow, do you know that? People laugh at you. People hate you. But why do they hate you? Because they are jealous!
What have I done? Have I just given life to a monster?
Good stuff. From 1910's Charles Ogle to the immortal Boris Karloff of the 30s and 40s, Glenn Strange in the sequels, then Christopher Lee in the 60s, to the string of actors who've done the role ever since, the monster lives. Well, this week, three Atlanta playwrights take a new look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein with some modern scientific research behind it, research conducted at Emory University. Frankenstein Goes Back to the Lab is now playing at the Atlanta Science Festival in Emory, and two of the playwrights behind this production join us this morning, Neely Gossett and Edith Frenny. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's up with this adaptation of Frankenstein? How is this different from all of the others that we've just been listening to little bits of?
Well, we started with the book, and that's pretty much where we're leaving the monster. We started, the three of us, by reading the book and then having a conversation about it with three scientists or science professors from Emory. And then kind of came up with a couple of parts, elements that we all were going to go away and write into these plays. We had 2 days to write them, and we had to make sure all of those elements were included. And so the four plays that came out of the initial workshop are all so vastly different and kind of touch on the big themes in Frankenstein in really interesting and unique ways.
Okay, so interesting thing there. So Neely, clarify for us, is this sort of one play about Frankenstein or divided into separate acts that are each written by y'all different playwrights? Or do you really conceive of these each as tiny little plays that are distinct entities?
They're actually three different plays, one by myself, one by Edith, and then one by Adai Moon is also a playwright involved. And they originally were full-length plays that we wrote in 2 days. Now we're putting them together as three separate short plays. So they'll run about an hour and a half, but they'll be three separate entities.
Yeah, there a couple of them are excerpts, and then I think we're hearing Adai's entire play.
Okay. Edith, why don't you tell us about your play?
Well, the full-length play is a bit of a wild ride. It takes place, it starts in the late 1960s and then has four short acts that all jump forward about 100 to 150 years into the future. It's got lots and lots of different characters, lots of settings. One of the settings is the moon. So it's sort of this epic exploration of mostly the thematic content that we were exploring when we were reading the book and talking to the scientist collaborators at Emory.
At the risk of asking a playwright to act, could you give us a little taste?
Sure, of course I can.
I'm sure you're a good actor, too. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I've been accused of that occasionally, but not too much. The excerpt that I'm going to be reading is from a section. There is a sort of tropic exploration of the relationship between a monster and a creator. It takes place about 250 years in the future. The future has been is now a kind of post-apocalyptic medievalism, and the monster is trapped in a tower on an island in the middle of a sea, and his scientist is keeping him captive, and he's been visited by this little girl named Mary, and they're having a conversation about trying to figure out whether or not he's human. She's trying to figure that out from him, and so they're having this conversation to figure that out. So the monster is the first to speak. He says, "I think I need to admit something to you." Mary says, "What's that?" "I'm not sure I even know what human is." "Well, humans are members of the species Homo sapiens sapiens, which is Latin for man who knows and knows he knows. They are the only extant members of the subtribe Hominina, a branch of the tribe Homininae, belonging to the family of great apes." "Did you make that up?" "Not at all. I learned it at school." "What is school?" "A place where they send children to learn." "I will never learn then." "Why not?" "I will never leave here." "Why not?" "Because he won't let me." "If you are human, as you suspect, then the scientist can't keep you here." "He can't?" "No. Humans are free to come and go as they please." "Then perhaps I am not a human after all." And it goes on from there.
That's playwright Edith Frenney reading from an excerpt of the play that she has written about or inspired by or based upon Mary Shelley's immortal Frankenstein's monster story. It's part of a series of short plays playing at the Atlanta Science Festival that are sort of marrying the Frankenstein story with modern scientific research done at Emory University. Edith, what was the germ of that play that you got from talking to the scientists?
Oh my goodness, there were like 8 germs, which I think is why the play goes in so many different directions. I was really interested in some of the stuff that David Lin, who's one of the professors at Emory, deals in synthetic biology and the sort of quest to create life from nothing, which is really what Frankenstein is about. You know, there's a lot. There's Mary Shelley doesn't really go into. It's not a scientific book. She doesn't really talk about how Victor Frankenstein did what he did. But that question.
Reanimated a dead guy.
Yeah, reanimated a dead guy, exactly, from a bunch of parts of other dead guys. And so the scientists that we were talking about are also working in that sort of realm of how do we make life from non-life, right? And then one of the questions on the table was, what actually is life? Which I think was a question that most of us hadn't ever asked before. So that was a big jumping off point for me in sort of looking at, well, where does life begin? If we wanted to make it from nothing, how would we start that process?
Neely Gossett, you also wrote a little play inspired by Frankenstein and marrying it with modern science. Where did you take yours?
It was inspired by the same ideas that Edith was just talking about, but it's a very, very different play. I ended up looking at cloning because I feel like that is creation of life, like Frankenstein. So I wanted to look at a type of cloning that could really happen. So I looked at cloning of butterflies, and I was also inspired by the idea of the year without summer. Frankenstein was actually written because there was a volcanic eruption that covered Europe, and Mary Shelley was on vacation and they couldn't get outside. So she and Percy Shelley and Byron had a competition to see who could write the best novel within those few days. And that's how Frankenstein came to be. So I also wanted to play with The Year Without Summer.
Could we get a taste of yours?
Yes. When Mount Tambora erupted and the cloud of volcanic ash covered the earth, new bacteria was formed, which affected particular subspecies of butterflies. The bacteria killed the males before they even hatched. I know butterflies seem like a small thing in comparison to crops dying and cholera outbreaks, but one link can really affect the whole ecosystem.
Sounds great. We're talking to playwrights Edith Frenney and Neely Gossett, who have taken a fresh look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and written short plays that are inspired by that story and marrying it with modern science being done at Emory University. It's playing as part of Atlanta Science Festival right now. And Neely and Edith, something that should be pointed out maybe is that Frankenstein is science fiction, and science fiction is a genre historically dominated by men. Mary Shelley wrote one of the foundational works of this genre, specifically of science fiction horror, and she's a woman. And so are you two playwrights who are updating this work for the 21st century. Does that fact have any particular resonance for you? It's interesting, you know, science fiction, of course, a genre historically dominated by men, but Mary Shelley wrote this seminal work, and she's a woman, and both of you are women. All of the playwrights who worked on this project are women. Does that fact have any particular resonance with either of you?
Well, she was also a very, very young woman at the time that she wrote the novel, and surrounded by men. I somehow the title of my play is The Rights of Men, so it's very much a play about men in the sciences and the sort of great discoveries and advances that we can thank men for, and also the kind of terrifying and terrible advances that we can thank them for as well. I mean, and I know that this is a topic of you know, much discussion now in terms of how to get more women involved in STEM fields, sort of the underrepresentation of women in STEM fields. Men have traditionally dominated these fields. So that my play became a play very much about men and male relationships, I think was really inspired by the fact that Mary Shelley was on this sort of long retreat with her husband and Lord Byron, and sort of living in the shadow of both of those men at the time that she was writing this most incredible novel.
And mine actually has a female protagonist, and another main character is a woman. There's only one man in mine, and the scientist in mine is female. But I think it is a little bit different, her being female, because she's also dealing with personal decisions as far as whether or not to use a surrogate to carry a child. So there's some scientific decisions in there that are particularly female.
Well, that's Neely Gossett and Edith Frenney, both playwrights behind the new project Frankenstein Goes Back to the Lab, mirroring Mary Shelley's Frankenstein story with modern science, done at Emory University. It's playing right now as part of the Atlanta Science Festival at Emory. You can go to gpbnews.org /onsecondthought to get some more information on that. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. In recent years, churches have seen a big shift in attendance among African Americans. The Pew Research Center finds that only 10% of African Americans in Georgia identified as evangelical Protestant in 2014. Nationwide, that's even lower. Pew says that Georgia's share of black evangelicals has dropped in recent years. What is behind that? Let's find out. Shaniqua Walker-Barnes is an associate professor of pastoral care at Mercer University, where I should say that I also work. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us by Skype, Robert P. Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's the author of the book, The End of White Christian America, looking at big demographic changes around race and religion in the United States. Welcome back to the program, Robert.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Also with us is Pastor Lee Campbell Taylor of Oakhurst Presbyterian Church in Decatur, Georgia. Hello.
Good morning.
Shaniqua, let me start with you. First of all, we're talking about a decline of participation of African Americans in evangelical churches. Just remind us, what's an evangelical church?
So an evangelical church typically is a church that takes a literal view of the Bible. They tend to be churches that really integrate a lot of culture. We tend to see evangelicalism identify with certain types of denominations, Southern Baptists. There are a lot of non-denominational churches that are evangelical, but there are also churches that are in what we call our mainline traditions that would also fall in that sort of evangelical camp.
Mainline Protestantism in
yes.
particular, right?
Yes.
Okay. You used to go to an evangelical church, and you left. Why?
Yes. Well, in part because I was part of a church plant that was not supposed to be evangelical, but our culture became increasingly obviously evangelical. And one of the things that we were really supposed to be about was justice and about being a truly multicultural community, not just multiracial. Many multiracial churches, they have people that look different, but everybody has the same culture. They often tend to be from the same socioeconomic status and so on. The worship tends to very much represent white culture, the music, the preaching style, even in terms of the length of the service. And so for me, it was a matter of integrity in terms of being about what we said we were going to be about, which is a church that was truly multicultural. And the further we kind of got into what we were doing, we weren't.
Okay. Robert, could you unpack for us the historical connections between evangelicalism and whiteness?
Sure. Well, you know, it's important to remember that once upon a time in America, churches, Christian churches, including evangelical churches, were in fact integrated. And that was true up until really the 1840s. But they were integrated with white slave owners and their slaves, with whites sitting in the front of the church and slaves sitting in the back of the church or in the balcony. One great example right there in Georgia is right there in Macon. There are two First Baptist churches in downtown Macon. One is white, one is black. They used to be a single church founded in the 1820s. They split in the 1840s when whites basically took up the cause of secession and removed African Americans, who at the time actually outnumbered them 2-1, removed them from the church. It became an all-white church, and the African Americans in the congregation just went literally around the corner, formed their own First Baptist Church, and those two churches stand there to this day. And they have been doing some cooperative things, but they are still largely monoracial churches. And that's the story across the country today. You know, Martin Luther King was famous for saying 11 o'clock a.m. on Sunday mornings is the most segregated time in American society. There have been some improvements on that. But if we take a definition that sociologists use, that is a church where no single ethnic group makes up more than 80% of the participants, we're still only looking at our latest data says that in the U.S. only about 20% of churches fit that definition, where no group makes up more than 80% of the participants. So very, very slow improvements. It has come up from 15% in the mid-1990s. But as you can see, that's a pretty incremental improvement.
And what your observation reveals to me, Robert, is that politics has always been a big part of this entire discussion. We're talking, I should remind listeners, about the decline of participation of African Americans in evangelical churches in Georgia and nationwide. And I suppose the evangelical Christian tradition to me in the year 2018 is particularly associated with conservative politics, with the Republican Party, and a lot of African Americans don't identify with. Is that an increasing phenomenon, Robert, or is that something that's always been the case?
Well, it's been the case since the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, if you look at the identities of the two political parties we have today are really rooted in their responses to civil rights. I think it's something that's often overlooked, but particularly in the South. You know, we used to talk about a generation ago the solid Democratic South. But as the Democratic Party became identified as the party of civil rights, whites in the South really fled to the Republican Party. And by the time we get to Ronald Reagan, we have really a complete switch. Political scientists call it the Great White Switch that happened between the mid-1960s and Reagan's presidency in the 80s. And by that time, and that's the mold that we really have in our two political parties today. And increasingly, the Republican Party today, for example, is 70% white and Christian. The Democratic Party is 30% white and Christian. And these polarizations have been actually increasing over the last decade.
Right. That's Robert P. Jones. He's the author of the book, The End of White Christian America. Shaniqua Walker-Barnes, an associate professor of pastoral care at Mercer University. Same topic to you. To what extent is the exodus of African Americans from evangelical tradition churches, to what extent does that have to do with politics as opposed to faith tradition?
I think it has almost everything to do with politics. In many ways, a lot of the theology of our historically black traditions and our evangelical churches are similarly conservative on some issues, especially in terms of sexuality, in terms of gender. But there is a vast difference in terms of the approach to issues of race and really talking about race for reasons that Robert just discussed in terms of the background and the heritage of evangelicalism and when that initial split happened. Many African Americans who go to evangelical churches do it for reasons of family, do it for reasons because the theology in some ways seems to fit. But the heightened racial, not just polarization, but what we've really seen in terms of a sort of regression in racial oppression, for example, anti-black police brutality, some of those cases, the election of Donald Trump, those have made people want to talk about race in a lot of spaces. And what they found is when they begin to approach those conversations in evangelical spaces, they were told those conversations couldn't be had. They were often told that they were on the wrong side of those conversations. And so the spaces that people had thought were home, they increasingly realized that was not a home space for them. It was home only in the sense that they fit the mold of what an appropriate and proper evangelical Christian was supposed to do and talk about.
It's on Second Thought. We're talking about African-Americans going away from evangelical churches. Let's visit a church right now. Leah Campbell-Taylor is a pastor at Oakhurst Presbyterian Church in Decatur. And Lee, Presbyterianism is not a tradition that I associate with evangelicalism, although there is such a thing as the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. Do y'all identify as evangelical?
No, not at all.
And why not?
Well, we're part of the Presbyterian Church USA. It's a mainline Protestant denomination. It falls across the political spectrum, different congregations finding different places. We are certainly a more progressive congregation, but not evangelical, as it has been described here.
And your church is very multiracial.
Yes.
How have you achieved that?
First of all, it's not me who has achieved that. I feel very presumptuous being here, speaking on behalf of a church that is multiracial and multicultural. It has been a matter of intentionality, and it has been something that has happened over the last 30 or 40 years. It was a predominantly white, suburban kind of congregation, and then white flight changed that, and the numbers dwindled, but those who remained ended up an integrated congregation, and there was an intentionality of maintaining that by reaching out to the people who were near the church and addressing the challenges that were near the church. And then as the numbers have increased in the last 25 years, there has been this intentionality of finding a worship style that was hospitable to folks of different cultural and ethnic backgrounds and being welcoming in worship as well as in our programming to address, and as Shaniqua says, the need to talk about these issues and finding a safe place and stretching the ability to trust one another so that we can have these conversations that are not easy but are so important and are so rare.
If you're talking about race in church a lot, are there ever any attendees of the church who complain, why is there so much politics in church? I come here for faith, for theology.
Yes, and talking about race and talking about politics are not the same thing. I can talk about racism as, you know, if I'm preaching on one of Jesus's healing stories, I can talk about racism as an ailment that we must be healed of individually and culturally. And I don't have to identify myself anywhere as from a political label, but just somebody who recognizes and is, you know, possessed by that same demon that we all have to be healed of. So one of the aspects of a multicultural church is that you're going to have lots of different people with different needs, and that's one of the challenges. And so there will be people who say, do we have to talk about race all the time? And then there'll be people who want to talk about race all the time. And so we're navigating that. But you're exactly right. People come to church for joy, for comfort, for hope. It is a faith experience set within these cultural contexts.
That's Lee Campbell-Taylor of Oakhurst Presbyterian Church in Decatur. We're talking about the decline of African-Americans in their participation in evangelical churches in Georgia and nationwide. Listeners, did you choose to leave your church based on racial issues? Tell us your story. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. And going back to Shaniqua Walker-Barnes, Associate Professor of Pastoral Care at Mercer University, to what extent do you think that evangelicalism as a faith tradition, as a theological construct, could be severable from the conservative politics that have so come to define it, especially in the modern era? Are these two things that can be pulled apart, and should they be pulled apart?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in light of the overwhelming evangelical support for President Trump, not only in electing him, but even recently, I think there was a study showing evangelicals, most white evangelical Christians, still tend to overwhelmingly support him. I think you can't tease those apart. And again, it gets back to the history that the evangelical church was birthed in this political conservatism, this anti-racial, especially once the church is split, this anti-blackness is really inherent to the evangelical church. And there have been people who have been working very faithfully and very urgently, I think over several decades, to try to work against that. The whole racial reconciliation movement has been huge in the evangelical church. And many of the folks who've been doing that work really felt as if their life's work had been for nothing after the election of Donald Trump. And it speaks to the fact that there is something deeply wrong at the core of the white evangelical church. And I don't think this is limited to evangelicals. I think this is a problem of mainline Protestantism, too. And it's the problem of what happens when you develop your Christianity in the context of being a slaveholding society, and the way in which your theology ends up changing to conform and to affirm your right to own other human beings. The white church has never grappled with that on a large-scale basis.
Robert P. Jones, author of The End of White Christian America, same essential question to you in the last couple of minutes that we have here. To what extent, in your mind, is mainline Protestantism, evangelicalism in particular, to what extent are these faith traditions things that could be pulled apart from the racial and political attitudes that have and continue to drive away African-American parishioners?
Well, I largely agree with what's already been said, that the genesis of the denominations we have today matter, you know, that they really were formed out of, you know, very early on out of a reaction to slavery, and then also, you know, even later out of the white citizens' councils and resistance to civil rights. I mean, that is the history that we have in the white Protestant church, particularly in the evangelical tradition in the South. Just to put a fine point on this, I mean, in the last election, to show you how far apart politically African-American Protestants and white evangelical Protestants are, 8 in 10 white evangelical Protestants voted for President Trump. 9 in 10 African-American Protestants voted for Hillary Clinton. And so we're politically just very, very far apart. And that leads to, you know, a lot of tensions when you're sitting down the pew from someone. And this election was so divisive along lines of race in particular that I think those tensions are heightened, and progress that has been made, I think, is under threat in the current environment. And one last point I'll make is the other thing that I think happened in white evangelical Protestantism is going to the theological point is that it did become a highly personalized kind of theology that has not a great set of tools or lenses for seeing systemic injustice. And just to kind of show you how that plays out on a very—
10 seconds.
On a very concrete issue, killings of African-American men by police. 75% of African-Americans say that's part of a broader pattern of how police treat African-Americans. Only 29% of white evangelical Protestants agree with that statement. And just in that one issue, we see the, you know, we see the divide.
And we'll have to leave it there. Robert P. Jones is the author of The End of White Christian America. We were also joined by Shaniqua Walker-Barnes of Mercer University and Lee Campbell-Taylor of Oakhurst Presbyterian Church. It's on Second Thought. Pearl Clegg's career as a playwright spans decades. One of her earliest works was 1983's Hospice. This play was a story of a woman named Jenny who has to face her mother's rapidly approaching death, hence the title Hospice. Then, more than 30 years later, Clegg came back to the same material, the same character, and wrote the play Pointing at the Moon. Now, Atlanta's Alliance Theater Company is going to perform both of those shows back-to-back, starting this week at the Fulton County Southwest Art Center. And Pearl Clegg is the Alliance's playwright in residence, and she joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So get into some detail. We'll talk about these two plays as separate things and talk about putting them together. So this 1983 play that you wrote long, long time ago called Hospice, what's the basic outline of the story?
It's a mother who left her family, left her daughter when the daughter was 10 years old, left her husband in charge of raising the daughter because she was a poet. She was an artist. And her husband was a civil rights leader and didn't really have the kind of life that the mother, who is Alice, felt like she could really live within that life, the structure of his life, and be the artist and poet she wanted to be. So she left and went to Paris, stayed there for 20 years, had no contact with her daughter at all, and then became very ill while she was in Paris and came home pretty much because she knew she was dying. And the mother and daughter encounter each other after 20 years and try to have a conversation across all that time and space.
So you write that play in 1983. It's very well received. You have a very successful career. More than three decades later, you decide you want to come back to Jenny's story and write another play. What made you want to come back to it?
Well, I always liked those two characters a lot. They were very interesting to me. And when I wrote the play, I was closer in age to the daughter, and I was really looking at the kinds of questions that I think daughters will often ask their mothers. You know, please tell me what it means to be a woman. Tell me how to be successful at what I want to do. Explain life to me. And I, at the time that I wrote the play, I actually believed that mothers had the answers to all those questions. 30 years later, having been a mother and yeah. now a grandmother, I understand that those questions are really futile because everybody is doing the best they can. They give you the best advice they can, but it's not like because you become a mother, you become this oracle who can explain life to your daughter. So I kind of wanted to catch up with Jenny and see who did she grow up to be? How did her mother influence the choices that she made in her life? And who was she now at this moment in time?
Yeah, and I imagine also see how you related to the material, given that you now identify with the mother more than with the daughter.
Yeah, I feel like I understand them both. I felt like I understood the daughter really well at the time, and I thought I understood the mother. But then as time goes by, you realize that life gives you a chance to really understand from many different points of view if you keep your eyes open. So that I hope I've done that in coming back to Jenny to look at her and also look at some of those same questions. But one of the things that really was of interest to me was when I'd realized in the first place she's a young woman and she's dealing with family. She wants answers from her mother. She wants to understand her father. And so was I at that point, really looking at my family with a very critical eye and trying to understand how I fit in and what the lessons were that they had taught me. 30 years later, Jenny is a full-grown woman. She's had a wonderful life. She's still having a great life, but she's much more involved in trying to understand the wider world, what's going on in the country, what's going on with the political winds of the country, how is it moving in a direction that she likes, moving in a direction that she doesn't like. But she's much more involved with the wider world because she's pretty much made peace with her family.
We're talking to the legendary Atlanta playwright Pearl Clegg, who wrote in 1983 a play called Hospice, and then 30 years later wrote a play called Pointing at the Moon, about the same material, same characters, material that she chose to revisit three decades later in her life. And then what's going to happen this week is that at the Fulton County Southwest Arts Center, the Alliance Theater Company is going to play both shows back to back so we can see that journey essentially in real time. That sounds terrific from a dramatic standpoint, Pearl, but I wonder, how do you feel seeing work that you did when you were much younger juxtaposed so directly with work when you were a much more mature artist?
Well, of course, there's that moment where you say to yourself, wow, if I was writing that now, I would do this differently or I would do that differently. But I think if you're going to remount a play, it's dangerous to start trying to fix it and make it what you would write if you wrote it now, because you can't really do that. It's like pulling that thread on a sweater where if you do one thing, you've got to do two, you've got to do three, you might as well write another play. So that I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised that when I read the play, it really holds up for me because the questions I'm dealing with in Hospice are really not time-specific questions. They're questions about family, about women, about mothers and daughters, and that dance goes on. That isn't something that changes, you know, from year to year. So that it really wasn't difficult for me to look at this play and think of it as something that I could still embrace, could still look at, and think was still raising questions that were important to me. But there is that moment where you hear something or see something and you say, wow, I would have known how to work around that problem if I had written this play now. But you can't. You have to learn as you go.
I have no doubt. What about the emotional journey that you go through watching these two things side by side? Do you still feel when you're watching the first play from 1983 Hospice, do you still feel like you're identifying with Jenny? And then when you get to the later play, are you identifying more with the mother, or are you identifying more with the mother all the way through?
Well, the mother actually passes away at the end of the first one, so she doesn't come forward to the second one, because she does pass away at the end of the first play. But the second play, Jenny is dealing with a friend and neighbor of hers who is younger than she is, who's about 45 years old. Jenny's 60. So that I find that I definitely identify, understand the mother in Hospice much more. I understand the choices that she made, and I don't judge her, I think, as harshly as I did when I was younger. For the new play, I certainly identify very much with Jenny, not only because we're closer in age, but also just because of the questions that she's looking at. You know, she's a person who was very much involved in the civil rights movement because of her father. She's a person who's been very much involved in the black arts movement. She teaches at a historically black college. So that she's looking around at some of the political changes in the country today and saying, this is not the direction that I thought my country would be moving in at this moment. And what does that mean for me as an artist? What does that mean for me as a teacher? And how will that impact my work? So I certainly understand and relate to those questions, because I think those are the questions that I have been asking myself and have wanted to come up with answers that I thought were, okay, now I feel better about everything because I get it. But I'm still in process with trying to understand what's going on at this moment and what that means for me as a writer, what kinds of work I want to explore at this moment that allow my neighbors to enter that same discussion and consideration with me.
Before we close, let's just give people a taste from the production in Hospice. That's the older play from 1983. We meet Jenny and her estranged mother, Alice, who is dying. Alice lived abroad for years away from her daughter. Let's listen to a scene featuring Alice talking to Jenny about their time apart. This is from a recent rehearsal.
Almost 20 years abroad, sister. And you want to know what I learned? I learned my name is Alice, not Simone. And the left bank is not as far away from Southwest Atlanta as I was hoping it would be.
It was as far away as another planet to me.
I don't have the energy to figure out what it is you need to know and tell it to you.
All right. That's from Hospice, 1983. The production of that play and the further play written by Pearl Clegg 30 years later is on stage this Friday at the Fulton County Southwest Arts Center. Details at gpbnews.org. Pearl, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We heard how Pearl Clegg waited years to do a follow-up to one of her earlier works. Finally today, let's hear from a novelist who spent 20 years agonizing over her masterpiece novel, only to update it. Author Karen Hall released her book Dark Debts in 1996. It's the story of the devil tormenting a Georgia family, and it was an instant success when it came out. Instead of releasing another novel, she returned to the story with some major plot changes, including a new ending. GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley talked with Hall back in 2016 about the story that she couldn't quite let go of.
Tell me about when you very first began to write this novel. What would be your first, and until now, only novel? Why this subject matter? And I wonder, you were doing so much writing for other things, for other people's storylines. How did you land on this subject?
I had a friend whose mother was convinced that there was a demonic curse on their family, and I thought she had a case that would hold up in court because I knew details about the family. And I just thought that would be an interesting thing to look at. I thought, you know, could you make an intelligent case for that? And that's where I started.
And you ended up with what became a bestseller. What was that like the first time around? Did you feel before it went to the printing press that the book, that you were finished with it, that you were happy with it?
No, actually, because I wrote myself into a corner because I knew that if the book had lasted for a few more days, that my protagonist would have made a different decision. But I had written him as someone who didn't learn fast and wasn't going to turn on a dime. So I was kind of stuck with where he ended up at the end of the book. But what I thought at the time was I'll write a sequel and I'll finish it. And then I tried to write a sequel, and I have a file drawer full of chapter ones for the sequel, but it just never went anywhere. And then when I got a chance to rewrite it, I could do what I wanted to with that character.
what was it about the original version of the novel that you couldn't let go of?
There were several things, and one was just the protagonist was not done with me. So whenever I try to write something else, I just kept hearing his voice. But pragmatically, I just knew that I had become a better writer, and I wanted to make the book better. And there was also the fact that when I wrote the book, I had converted to Catholicism not long before the book came out. And so my take on it was really simplistic. And as I learned more and knew that more, I felt bad about it. And I wanted to be able to go back and, you know, I can't do it justice in terms of how complicated it is, but I wanted to be able to show a broader view.
You also took, in the new version, it's a little less gory. You took out a particular killing spree. I'm trying to be very careful and not give anything away, okay, either about the original version or the new version. But you did choose to take out some fairly violent scenes. Why?
You know, I took out the really gory scene because I just didn't feel like I needed it. And I guess the first time around I thought I did, but it just seemed to me that what was going on really had more to do with the main characters and what was going on inside them. And also I had some complaints from people who didn't like the fact that one of the protagonists basically got away with murder, you know, by saying the devil did it. And I didn't know how I felt about that, so I thought since I didn't need it, I would just take it out.
And can you tell me what that conversation was like with the publisher? Because I understand it. The publisher came to you and said, hey, let's reissue this book.
Well, my publisher is John Karp, who published the first edition at Random House, and then this edition is at Simon & Schuster. And he had mentioned to me somewhere in the last 20 years that he had always wanted to take a book that a writer had written and let them go back and rewrite it many years later to see how it would change. And when he said that, it stuck in my mind, and I didn't think, let's do my book, but it just, I thought that was an interesting concept. So I actually had someone was trying to buy the rights to the book to do an audio drama, and it looked like it was going forward. It actually didn't, but I called John and said, this is happening, so you might want to, you know, release the book again. And so we realized that it would be the 20th anniversary, and so I said, you know that thing you said about you would like to have somebody go back and rewrite their book? Could that be me? And he said, yes.
So then that begs the question, if now you think you could, I mean, have you exercised your demons, pardon the pun?
With this novel?
Yeah.
I think so. It's not on my mind like it used to be. And I feel pretty good about where I left it.
You changed the whole ending.
I did.
Don't tell us what it is.
I won't tell you the ending, but I'll tell you that part of the reason I changed it, I never quite felt right about it, but the main reason I changed it was because the ending was very internal in the book the first time, and it was in the characters' minds, and, you know, I'm always now writing with the idea of this could be a movie, too, so I knew I had to do something to fix the fact that the ending was too internal. So I went back and wrote something that you could film.
You just said that you don't think about the novel now as much as you used to. What has that been like for 20 years? How often did you think about this novel?
Way too often, and it was really distracting because I had other ideas for novels that I wanted to write, and I just could not get that one out of my head.
But what was that like when you sat down to write something else? What would happen?
It's hard to say. It wasn't so much when I sat down. It was just that the character would just pop into my head all the time. And usually when I write a character, by the time I'm finished with the project, I'm done with that character. So, you know, he kept coming back to me, and, you know, I felt kind of haunted by the character.
And so that is not happening anymore?
No.
Are you prepared for readers to say they liked the first version better?
I don't have a problem with that. You know, and the thing about a book is I also owned a bookstore until very recently. And the thing about a book is, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. some people are going to prefer the first book and some people are going to prefer the second. And when I give them out now, I kind of explain to them what the differences are to see which one they want.
That was Karen Hall, author of the 1996 novel Dark Debts, which she reimagined in 2016 with an updated version. Karen spoke with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. And that's our show for today, but as always, we want to hear from you. We talked earlier in the show about reimagining Frankenstein with modern science and sensibilities. So is there any sci-fi movie or TV show that you can think of that would benefit from more, shall we say, facts? Give us a call at 404-500-9457, or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk on Twitter. Our show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer, and Don Smith edits the show. Tanya Ott is the executive producer. The engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to the interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.